Wow. Thank you so much for being here this evening. See so many friends. I always feel at home in Berkeley, living. My wife Sheila and I, who some of you actually know, have lived in Florida, La Florida, as we call it down there, since 2008. And just being back in Berkeley, I had to remind myself, hey, in Berkeley, crosswalks mean something. Cars have to stop for pedestrians here. In Florida, it's the other way around. In Florida, the driver always has the right of way. So that's, I'm having to learn different cultural code switchings and stuff, you know. But really, thank you so much, KPFA, the wonderful church, wonderful friends and colleagues for having me back in Berkeley now. I feel like this is quickly becoming my second home or my home away from home. I gave a talk at UC Berkeley not too long ago. And actually, earlier this morning, I was at San Jose City College talking to ethnic studies and Mexican American studies students. And it was such a treat. It was so cool to be at San Jose City College. What was really cool, too, was that two of my former students from UC Santa Cruz are actually now Chicano studies professors there. And the students are doing incredible work in trying to change the curriculum, not only of their community college, but of their high schools where they came from, to make those curriculums, not to, you know, to create fantasies or stories that aren't true, but to try to get U.S. history back to where it should have been all along, where nations like Haiti, Cuba, Mexico, were always at the center of U.S. history. And it's kind of a truth we lost. And I'm not the only person doing it. A lot of people are really part of this historical reclamation project. But it's my great honor to be able to introduce to you right now a dear friend who's actually going to start us off with some spoken word, some poetry. And he's been to Berkeley before, I know. He's been to the Bay Area on many occasions. He's given poetry workshops. He's given readings. His name is Matt Cedillo. And if you don't know who Matt Cedillo is now, you will know. Because for many years, when we would introduce Matt as he goes across the country and the world to offer his poetry, his people's poetry, you know, Chicano poetry, poetry of the oppressed, poetry of working class people, for many years we'd say, now I can introduce, or now I'd like to introduce Matt Cedillo, one of the nation's top Chicano poets, a person who studied and was mentored by Luis J. Rodriguez, who, as many of you know, author of The Republic of East L.A., Music of the Mill, and other incredible works of Chicano and American history. Now, I say we used to say that about Matt Cedillo, but now I think it's safe to say, as a labor historian, I can say this, Matt has finished his apprenticeship, and he has really become, in his own right, what I think now, or who I think now, is America's foremost radical poet, and really a people's poet of working class history. And Matt contacted me a short while ago and said, you know, I've read your book, and I've written a poem about it. Would you allow me to read the poem? I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Yes. And so tonight we have a rare treat. This is really worth the price of admission, y'all. And this morning, Matt previewed the poem for the San Jose City College students, and I know they were blown away, and I think you'll be blown away as well. So without any further delay, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Matt Cedillo, who's going to read A Rifle and a Press.
No pressure, right? All right. The one true legacy of murderers and thieves are the lies left behind, then later enshrined to provide the prevailing wisdom, the governing census, the founding tenants, a kingdom, a continent, a scripture, a doctrine, indigo, sugar, tobacco, molasses, landmass, and human traffic, insult to injury, assault upon memory, the court, the Congress, the Senate, the executive, the republic, the market, The cotton that lines their pockets, cycles of deception, packaged as generations, repackaged, then repurposed as seasons of election without end. Progress is a racket, resistance as a commodity, because nothing ever changes without a drop of blood, a drop of sweat, a drop of ink, a rifle, and a press with a story seldom told without portraits of sharecroppers, tenant farmers, campesinos, strong and organized, murals of fire, choirs of dynamite, the plot line, less traveled, the poetry of a Winchester in the hands of an abolitionist, the power in the union's raised fist, the connections between stolen acres, Texas Rangers, chain gangs, and prison laborers, working class insurrection, the bracero and the vagrant, Jim Crow and Mexican repatriation, segregation, wage theft, and suppression, slave rebellions, and national liberation, the salt and the wretched unearth, the truth buried in plain sight, the truth of our everyday lives, destinies collide, and legacies of ballots and bullets, the land and those who work at Tupac, Toussaint, Dubois, Parsons, the shotgun and the scribe, the world never dies, the word never dies, the word never dies, so long as there are those born with cause to fight.
We can hold the mics. There we go.
You're never supposed to tap a mic, by the way. Every sound person can tell you that. I just broke a cardinal rule. I'm sorry.
All right. Mr. Paul Ortiz, thank you so much. And folks, get your questions ready so we can ask away. And what I found very interesting about your book is how you go way back to the beginning, I like to say, the beginning of the United States, that history, the slave trade, and you take it and you pull it together. I'd like to read a quote from your book, and you quote Frederick Douglass quite a bit, which is definitely important. The problems that Douglass identified, the United States' propensity to wage self-destructive wars on other nations, avarice, racism, and the suppression of dissent continue to plague the nation into the 21st century. Let's start with you giving examples of how it was back then and how it still is today in the 21st century.
Sabrina, I'm glad you asked. Start with this question of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass is a person who I look to among others, to provide a radically different interpretation of U.S. history than the history that I was taught. And he arrives at this new interpretation of history because of his lifelong struggle against slavery. He's seen what the nation's wealth is built upon. Douglass, and he certainly isn't the only one, but he's certainly one of the most eloquent to reveal the underpinnings, the creation, the invention of American capitalism. But in that passage that you quote, Douglass is also one of the strongest critics against imperialism, because he sees racism, capitalism, and slavery working together. If you think of 19th century U.S. history, and we try to look at the world the way Frederick Douglass looked at it, it's kind of like what my students have told me, and so much of this book really comes out of discussions I've had with students in my classes. I've taught a course called African American and Latino Histories for about 20 years now. And what he was trying to really get across is something my students have referred to as the Star Wars effect of U.S. history. And what they mean by this is that they say, you know, the way you describe the U.S. in the 19th century is all of the nations around the U.S., especially Mexico, but Canada, even Great Britain, France, are all moving away from slavery, right? The U.S. and Native American nations, certainly, but the U.S. is actually expanding slavery. That's why they say, wow, your book is like reading, what was that Star Wars one about the rebel, you know, the
I'm not a Starbucks fan. Okay. Starbucks either. A Star Wars fan. Can anyone answer that question? The Return of the Jedi, maybe?
You know, one of the last ones, I think. But okay. What they were getting at is, you know, the U.S. is this big empire. And first of all, that kind of blew my mind. When I read Douglas talking about the U.S. as an empire, right. Me, I didn't grow up with that kind of interpretation. But I'm a former soldier of empire. You know, I was in the military. I was in Central America in the mid-1980s. And so that's the first time I got an inkling that the U.S. is actually an empire. Now, most history textbooks don't talk about it that way. Mm-hmm. But to answer your original question, that what Douglas is saying is that we can't solve the problems of slavery and racism and inequality in the United States unless we address the problem of imperialism and aggressive warfare. Because this is why the U.S. wages war on all the nations around it. This is why the U.S. invades Mexico. I mean, I was taught a fantasy of an event called the Mexican-American War, mm. Right? It's the U.S. invasion of Mexico to reimpose slavery and domination. And so trying to see the world from Douglas's perspective, and this is when people would ask Douglas, why is the U.S. invading slavery? You know, he'd always kind of skip a beat, and he'd say, well, you don't know why? It's because of slavery. And so connecting internal and domestic oppression with military aggression overseas, and me being a part of that military aggression in Central America and U.S. Special Forces, now it took me a while to process that. At age 22, I wasn't ready to have that kind of critique. Mm-hmm. But certainly in years later, I've realized, you know, the words of people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., when he is being asked to promote nonviolence in the United States, he's saying, you're asking me to go to young black and brown men, youth, high school students, tell them to be nonviolent, and yet next year you're going to put them in boot camp and you're going to send them overseas to fight the Vietnamese. So let's kind of get our act together here. If we're going to be nonviolent, let's be nonviolent. But you have to understand that the reason that we have this problem at home is because we have this problem abroad.
So Frederick Douglass preached against United States imperialism. You were a soldier of United States imperialism. Let's talk about the metamorphosis that you went through growing up. You talk about it in your book in the intro. So I don't think I'm stepping on too many toes by asking a somewhat personal question, because I mean, you went through a serious change and evolution as far as who Paul Ortiz is now and who Paul Ortiz was as a child. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a shipyard town primarily called Bremerton, Washington. Every adult that I grew up with or around had been either, you know, in the military, had fought in World War II, had been in Korea, had been in Vietnam. I was born in 1964. All the male members of my family had been in the military. Mm-hmm. And my father, you know, went into Marine boot camp in 1956. He remembers the hits that year, Buddy Holly and Bo Diddley. You know, that's how he kind of, my dad remembers history, just turned 81. But even, you know, his uncles, my great uncles, and my grandparents' generation all fought in the Mexican Revolution. That's how we ended up in the United States in 1914. The family moved to the United States the same time that the U.S. invaded Mexico to supposedly secure the oil fields around Tampico. And so growing up, the earliest photographs that we have of me as a young boy are photographs of me with guns. You know, first plastic guns, and then later, you know, when I learned how to shoot, real guns. So growing up, war was all we knew. And I remember as a young boy, you know, hearing about, you know, a friend's father who'd been killed in Vietnam, or a friend's uncle. And so that was really visceral for us. Fast forward, I'm going to go to the classroom, because so much of what I know I've learned from my students, some of whom are here. The first song that we play when I teach this course is Bob Marley's Buffalo Soldiers. To me, that's one of the most meaningful songs I've ever heard, and we spent a lot of time thinking and talking about Buffalo Soldiers and what that song means, because as people of color, as working class people, as oppressed people, we're often the first recruits who then turn around and then become the soldiers of empire. And I remember, again, Sabrina, I wish I could tell you that I, you know, became woke about U.S. imperialism when I was in the military, but that would not be true.
Really?
Where I grew up, there was no talk about nonviolence. There was no talk about being against the war. I didn't even know you could be against the war. I'm serious. I mean, I remember the first time I had an inkling that you could be opposed to war in this country when I was on my way home from deployment from Central America back to the United States. I read in a newspaper that this minister called Jesse Jackson was in Mexico City trying to broker a peace accord between the U.S. and nations of Latin America, Central America. I didn't know you could broker a peace accord because, again, growing up in a militaristic environment, and, you know, I told this story, I was talking to Matt Cedillo earlier about this, and this is going to sound very odd to people, but I remember the last day I was in the U.S. Army, I was in Panama City, and that last day, somehow I ended up in a small post. I was filling out paperwork, trying to get out of the military. And anyone who's been in the military knows you spend a lot of time. We have a phrase we call hurry up and wait, right? Hurry up and wait. And so you fill out paperwork and then you wait for someone to process it. And I remember walking across the street to the post library, a very small library, and I've always enjoyed reading. And I picked up this very thin volume out of the stacks. It had a very interesting, very intriguing title, and I started reading it. And this writer was talking about how his people have been oppressed for centuries. And it was time to stop being oppressed, and it was time to take action. And it was a moral imperative to take action. But he was using this language. He was saying, we need to take nonviolent direct action, nonviolent civil disobedience. And I had never heard of that in my entire life, because I grew up in a country, as Dr. King said, which is the most violent nation on earth. We're so violent, we don't even understand that for youth of the town I grew up in Bremerton, and there are many towns like Bremerton, we're raised to be fighters. We're raised to be soldiers. Like I said, the first photographs of me are with toy guns, toy pistols. The book I'm working on now, I'm trying to figure out, how did we get to be that way? And so I'm writing a book on settler colonialism, because my belief is that settler colonialism has so profoundly impacted our culture, we're not even aware of it. And so again, that's kind of, you know, going back to thinking about my trajectory, coming back to the United States. The first time I ever had a picket sign in my hand, it was to protest the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. Some of you remember that. And the premise that the U.S. government gave for that war was a complete lie. And I would hear stuff on the radio or on TV. I would hear my friends say, well, this is why we're invading Panama. And I'd say, you know, that's a complete lie. The other thing that kind of woke me up, if you will, was that when I came back home in 1987, friends that I'd grown up with, some of whom were veterans too, asked me, Paul, what are all these Hondurans doing in Los Angeles? What are all these El Salvadorans doing in Seattle? What are all these refugees doing? And so one of the first things, in fact, I met my wife doing this work in part, was getting involved in the sanctuary movement. Because I would tell my friends, I would say, you don't know why all these people are leaving Central America? You don't know what I was doing there? You don't know what U.S. foreign policy is actually giving, you know, military training and weaponizing the Central American conflicts, and this is why people have to leave. But when I would say these things to friends, and again, remember, these are people I grew up with, that I played sports with, they'd look at me and they would say, Paul, I just cannot accept what you're telling me. I was told that you went to Central America, I was told that we were in Central America to stop communism, and that's why we were there. And I would say, I'm sorry, but that's a lie. That's not true. That's not what we were doing. And then the next thing, the luckiest thing, one of the luckiest things in my life is that an older veteran who was in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War put a book in my hand. He said, son, you have to read this book. It's written by another combat veteran by the name of Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States. And because of the way Howard wrote the book, and I had the incredible honor of meeting him years later through Dana Frank, who many of you know is an incredible historian at UC Santa Cruz, that book really helped me quite a bit, as I think it's helped many of us.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. First taste of real history was Howard Zinn. Let's switch gears just a little bit back to your book, which is also a life changer. You've juxtaposed the position of Frederick Douglass at the time with the United Farm Workers publication entitled El Macriado, coverage of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in El Macriado. And you say, or let me quote your book, this was a 20th century version of Frederick Douglass's thesis in oppression and militarism destroyed the nation's ability to become truly democratic. And then you go on to say, this was a primer on how poor people would make history. They organized themselves. So you're again taking Frederick Douglass and then taking the United Farm Workers movement and putting it all together and giving a true history of how poor people have started to organize with the farm workers all the way back to Frederick Douglass. Talk about what needs to happen today. Juxtapose what needs to happen today with what has already happened. Because I feel like we're on the verge of something good, but there's a very good chance that we as poor people could lose our footing. You know, we as working class people could lose our footing. You know, we've got Bloomberg, another billionaire trying to get into the Democratic whatever primary or whatever election thing they have going on in 2020. I don't know what it is. Anyways, so yeah. We got to take that power back because we do have that power. And you give a great display of that power in the past, the people power. Talk about what we can do today to recreate that and that resurgence, that fire.
Yeah.
To want to do something and make change.
You're doing that on the radio. I know you're doing that. You do that, and all of us here play a role.
Thank you.
Right, in this struggle. I'm so glad, Sabrina, though, you mentioned this moment in 1968. We have to kind of think about this moment. Dr. King has just been assassinated. Sometimes I show my students headlines that were, or op-eds written about Dr. King in the last months of his life, and even after he was killed. And my students can't believe it, because they're reading hateful, spiteful words that come out of major American publications. Because what people have forgotten is that the nation's intelligentsia and elites, in many cases, turned against Dr. King. When he came out against the Vietnam War, when he came out against that lifting people out of poverty one by one bootstrap thing, and he said we have to abolish poverty across the board, the nation's elites turned against him. And many of the obituaries written in the weeks after his death are not flattering. They're shocking. You have this publication, El Macriado, which was a publication created by poor and working class Filipinos, Chicanos, African Americans, poor white people. And immediately, they offer one of the first comprehensive viewpoints or comprehensive analyses of Dr. King's life from their perspective as farm worker organizers. And the title of the journal, that issue, was Dr. King Was Killed Helping Workers to Organize. Killed Helping Workers to Organize. And the theme of the entire issue was to say that what we owe Dr. King is to not become cynical, to not become dispirited, because he overcame these obstacles. And when everyone in the society just about turned against him, he never lost hope or faith. And he went to be with the poorest workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He was creating, he had some of the best minds of the social justice and civil rights movement creating a poor people's campaign. And I have some dear colleagues, Gordon Mantler has written a wonderful book about the poor people's campaign. And in the middle of the planning for this campaign to abolish poverty, the Memphis sanitation workers strike breaks out. Memphis, Tennessee, and Dr. King has one of these aha moments. All of us middle class folk have been talking about creating this very intricate plan, and yet the poorest people in Memphis, Tennessee are doing it. They're gonna lift 1,300 workers out of poverty at one time, at one fell swoop, through union organizing, and I've got to be there. And so that's why that sequence or that series of events to me is so powerful, because what the union does is it says, again, if we're going to honor Dr. King, we do it through organizing social movements, you know, wherever we're at. And the issue talks about Dr. King, it talks about the I Have a Dream speech, it doesn't give short shrift to that, it talks about his religious background, it talks about the labor, it talks about also the beautiful words he said. It gets back to your earlier question. He says, you know, I talk to poor youth in Watts, Willowbrook, and Los Angeles who are on the cusp of being sent to kill poor youth in North Vietnam. That's not right. And so he's making those types of connections. And what I'm trying to say with this book really is what I've learned in years and years of research and in my own organizing experiences. I mean, I actually met my wife during an 8-year labor boycott, the boycott of Chateau Saint-Michel Wines, which is a long UFW struggle, which resulted in a union contract which is still in force after 30-some years. That's years now of young Chicano students who have had the opportunity to go to college, their parents have pensions, you know, they have decent wages, but that came about only through struggle. I literally met my wife in the picket line. In fact, we ended up getting arrested together. And we thought after we went to jail together, we might as well get married. This coming June, we'll be celebrating our 25th wedding anniversary, actually. So for me, the personal has always been political. And I have to say, I've had so many incredible mentors along the way. I'm so grateful. I've been so blessed in my life. You may not believe this, what I'm about to tell you. At UC Santa Cruz, the first two dissertation committees that I was on as a junior professor were chaired by Dr. Angela Davis. And Angela was the person who really taught me how to be an intellectual in the academy. And people like Dr. Davis, Bettina Apthiger, Dana Frank, and then, you know, Howard Zinn, and so Rudy Acuna, Carlos Munoz, right here at UC Berkeley. I've had so many incredible mentors who at different points have taken me aside and have said, Paul, you know, like what you're doing, but, you know, I want you to think about this perspective, or I want you to try to reach the widest possible audience. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Roxanne's book, Indigenous Peoples, History of the United States. I would say if you're going to read any book, go read that book first before you read my book, because her book, Roxanne, since she's retired, has written how many books? Like every time you turn around, she has a new book, and they're all incredible, incredibly meaningful. But, you know, I've just been incredibly blessed to have these amazing mentors and guides.
Wow. Lucky you.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to switch gears again just a little bit. We're going to take a couple of questions from the audience. And let's see here. That's kind of a past tense question. All right. We're going to bring it forward here to some current events. U.S. capitalism fomented another racist coup over the weekend, this time in Bolivia, where the MAS movement lifted 20% of the population out of poverty. How do you recommend we build a movement to support democracy and self-determination in Latin America? That's from our audience.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So a lot of us are familiar with what's been happening in Bolivia, the right-wing coup, what's been happening in Chile, what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Morocco, what's even happening in many U.S. cities right now. Part of it is to educate each other and our friends about the role that the U.S. plays and has always played in Latin America and in Central America, and to try to get people to understand the role that capitalism has played in the underdevelopment and the profoundly unequal economic systems throughout the entire Americas, not just Bolivia. If you think about this, Evo Morales was the first indigenous president of Bolivia. I mean, that's an incredible thing to even contemplate, given the fact that this is an indigenous majority society. What was it that kept back indigenous people for centuries in countries like Bolivia? What is it now that allows the United States government to continue to tyrannize Native and indigenous people in this country, trying to take their water rights, trying to take their mineral rights? It's remarkable what's happening. I direct the oral history program at the University of Florida, and we've had students who've done oral histories with the Western Shoshone people in Nevada. We've had students who do oral histories with the Porch Creek in southeastern Alabama and other parts of the country. And I can tell you, all of those Native American nations are really under siege right now. The federal government, private capital, private interests are trying to take the resources away from them, all the way from Latin America to North America. So that, to me, is one of the exciting things about what's happening now in the indigenous rights movement. And we had a session in Louisville, Kentucky, just last weekend about this issue, was that indigenous groups are looking hemispheric wide now and saying our problems are not rooted just in one country. They're rooted across the entire hemisphere. So I think that, and then calling out American imperialism, you know, and one of the things in my book that I talked about, and again, I learned this from my movement and intellectual elders, is the concept of racial capitalism. And we have to think about these things working together, you know, in tandem. And the slavery that indigenous people were faced with, both in this country but also in Latin America, continues to really mark the entire hemisphere. But I think, you know, movement organizing, you know, teach-ins are really important. In Florida, this issue is particularly acute. I don't have to tell you, Florida is not like California. Don't get me wrong, we've done amazing things in Florida. We just finished an incredible 3-4 years long struggle, which culminated in Amendment 4, which overturned felony disenfranchisement. We got over 1 million signatures. We had canvassers who were canvassing in Haitian Creole and French and Spanish and English. We had to go, you know, to get 1 million signatures to lift felony disenfranchisement. You can't just go to the county fair to get 1 million signatures. We had to go to Miami Dolphins football games. Very angry fans, by the way, because they lose a lot of games. You know, we had to go to the not the usual places. We couldn't just go to our friends to get 1 million signatures. And this is an elliptical response to your very direct question. Part of what we have to do when we educate people about imperialism and talk about imperialism and talk about racism is we have to go outside of our comfort zones. This is one of the reasons I love oral history, is that, you know, in the classroom, when I teach at the University of Florida and in a workshop, yes, we're trying to create a respectful, you know, nurturing, inclusive space. But as soon as we begin getting outside of that space to be effective politically and to change things, we have to be very, you know, we're going into unsafe territory. We're going, and so for example, the last oral history interview that I did in Florida just a few weeks ago, I actually interviewed a retired Cuban-American former CIA operative who was involved in the Watergate break-in, who was involved in a lot of bad things, worse than Watergate, believe it or not. Daniel Ellsberg will be talking about that, right? You know, this guy was involved in torture and other things. And so you have to remember, in the Florida culture, it's very common to hear people say things like, well, if the military calls for the coup, then I guess we should support it. Now think about that for a minute. If the military calls for a coup, we should support it in Bolivia. What about the U.S.? What if the U.S. military called for a coup in this country? Should we support it? So these are the types of things that we need to, like, you know, talk to our neighbors about, talk to our families about. Families are divided over this issue. I'm actually the faculty advisor for a lot of Hispanic student organizations at UF. One of them was the Venezuelan Student Association. And we go back and forth, and they're like, well, you know, we have to support President Trump in Venezuela. I'm like, no, you don't.
They actually said that.
Oh, yes. And some of them.
You set them right.
And, well, we talk, we dialogue. I try not to, you know, to browbeat them. That's not an effective teaching technique, right? Be gentle, be kind. But
when you've got that kind of crazy coming out of somebody's mouth and they're astute, I mean, how do you, I don't know, okay.
Well, but see, Serena, this is where I can use my own background, because I say, look, yes. I'm not here to judge you, because, yeah. Again, I'm a soldier of empire, right? That's on my CV. I will never get rid of that. And so far be it for me to tell you, you can't have your beliefs, even if I think they're wrong, right?
Right. Yeah. But that's a lot of destructing, you know, deconstructing that you have to do to that person, and that takes time. It's like a layers of an onion almost, yeah. Where you gotta, you know, peel back the no, Trump is bad. Maduro was a democratically elected president. Okay, you know, it's just it takes time, which actually brings me to the next question. American exceptionalism, speaking of Trump being good, American exceptionalism versus the emancipatory internationalism. Talk to us about that, describe that. You talk about it at the beginning of your book, and you go back to it, back, and forth throughout the book. So emancipatory internationalism versus American exceptionalism.
So does everyone know what American exceptionalism is? Kind of, okay. So it's the belief, broadly shared by our two major political parties, that the U.S. is the greatest country on earth, that we really can't do much wrong, that when we do wrong, it's not because we set out to do bad things, it's because something went wrong along the way, okay? If you think of a book like Graham Greene's The Quiet American, Greene is trying to gently coax us out of this idea of American exceptionalism. But what American exceptionalism does, by saying that the U.S. is the greatest country on earth, the U.S. is a middle-class society, is it denies the reality of people or towns and neighborhoods that I grew up in. I didn't grow up in a middle-class culture society. Most people in the United States do not. Most of us grow up in working class communities. And American exceptionalism denies our very existence. We don't become successful. My father and all of his generation of young Mexican American teenagers had to drop out of school in the seventh grade to help support their families. So the whole thing about education, true for some people, not true for other people. So trying to situate the U.S. in a reality where the United States is as good or as bad as its actions, as our actions. And when we do wrong, let's come to grips with why we do wrong, especially if we do wrong over and over and over again. Okay? Emancipatory internationalism is this grassroots movement that people like Frederick Douglass, people like Harriet Tubman, people like Henry Highland Garnett, Antonio Maceo, Jose Martí, counterpose to the idea of American exceptionalism. And this is an idea of building solidarity across borders. Instead of building walls, of building build bridges. I start the book with the Haitian Revolution because this is the most important revolution from the vantage point of oppressed people in this country, all throughout the Americas. It's more important than the French Revolution. It's more important than the American Revolution. It's more important than those revolutions because it ends with the abolition of slavery. It's the first successful slave revolution in human history. Chapter 2 is about the Mexican War of Independence. And again, here is a revolution that reaches across borders to fire the imagination of the radical abolitionist movement in the United States, to where people are saying, wow, the Mexicans from the very outset in 1810 start their revolution against Spanish imperialism by striking a blow against slavery and the oppression of indigenous people. Wow, why couldn't we do that? What do we have to learn from that? And I guess the big thing is learning what this country has to learn from nations around us. When I talk to audiences, I'm a longtime member of Veterans for Peace, and when I talk to audiences about war and they say, well, our Constitution doesn't give us much of a way out, I say, then we need to study other constitutions. Let's start with the Mexican Constitution, which has a very long and venerable history of anti-interventionism. Mm-hmm. How often is it in modern history that Mexico gathers an air force or an army and invades another nation and carpet bombs another nation? Mm. How often has that happened? There's a reason for that. It's not accidental. There's political traditions that we can learn from. And that's part of emancipatory internationalism. And it's part of the idea that, again, I didn't invent this idea, but the idea that if I'm free and you're not free, and we're like right next to each other, neither of us are free. Mm. And this is the radical understanding of the abolitionist movement. You know, Beacon Press published this book. Beacon Press grew out of the anti-slavery movement in the antebellum period. That was the Unitarian tradition. The radical understanding that if I can say I'm free, but if you're next to me, you're not free. Now think about this. In chapter 3, and now I'm kind of going through the book chronologically. Chapter 3 is about the American Civil War. The argument is from the very beginning, African Americans understood this was an international crusade. Chapter 4, the first moments that witnessed the end of the American Civil War, Henry Highland Garnett, Douglas, and the other black abolitionists were asked to dismantle the American anti-slavery associations, organizations. There were hundreds of them. And it, from one vantage point, maybe it made sense in 1865. You know, look, we fought the good fight for many years. Many abolitionists, white, black, and Hispanic, were brutalized, were beaten, were killed, were really punished for being against slavery in this country. So you could forgive them in 1865 if they say, hey, it's time to kind of close up shop, celebrate our victories, and go home. Right. Okay. It did not happen that way. And Garnett and others, instead of just closing up the anti-slavery movement, as they said, what about Cuba? What about Brazil? What about serfdom in Russia? And if you look carefully at black newspapers published in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, they're all about this emancipatory internationalism. And they're like, who would we be as a people if the only people we cared about was ourselves? That's not our tradition. Our tradition is trying to think of freedom expansively. And this is one of the reasons why African-American abolitionists create the Cuban anti-slavery movement. Imagine this. Abolitionists like Garnett and Douglas are meeting face to face with people like Jose Marti, Antonio Maceo, in the Bowery, I think 62 Bowery is the address. The building, by the way, is still there in the Bowery in New York. And they have the headquarters, and they're meeting with members of the Cuban resistance in the 1860s and 1870s, planning out a strategy to try to create a free Cuba that doesn't involve U.S. invasion of Cuba, right? And so these are all kind of elements of emancipatory internationalism.
Wow. Okay, I'm educated now. Wow. It's amazing, amazing. All right, so we're going to switch gears just a little bit here and take another question from the audience. To what extent do you locate the origins of the Trump insurgency in the past 2008 global crisis of capitalism, and to what extent in a deeper national story of white nationalism and anxieties about demographic change? In short, was Trump a primarily class of race-based phenomena? Did I say that right, whoever wrote this?
Class or race.
I'm sorry?
Class or race.
Class or race. Okay, yeah. Class or race. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Donald Trump, I want to be a good historian, and this is something I learned from the people that taught me how to be a historian. To be a good historian, you have to have imagination. To be a good U.S. historian, you have to either be able to leave this country physically and be able to look at it from the vantage point of other people, or you, if you can't leave it physically, you have to do it imaginatively. You have to use your imagination. What does the U.S. look like to people in Bolivia or in Caracas right now or in Mexico City, where my wife and I were there for a month last year, and a lot of people joked with us, your president may not let you come back to your country. What would you do? Say, I would love to live in Mexico City. But in all seriousness, and this is going, you know, this is going to be hard for us to hear, because it's just, but I'm just going to say it. It involves the historical imagination. You could sit Donald Trump down at a table with Thomas Jefferson, with John Adams, with Andrew Jackson, with even a younger John Quincy Adams, and they would be best buds. They would congeal, they would come together over issues of race and class domination. They would have a common discourse, a common rhetoric. And I found this, I'm making this argument because I've read the papers of a lot of these so-called founding fathers. They had no love for anyone in this room, by the way. They really did not. If you read what Alexander Hamilton said, when the British evacuate the ports of New York and Savannah, and hundreds and even thousands of former slaves evacuate with them, Alexander Hamilton is apoplectic. Mm. They've stolen our property, our property. When poor farmers in western Pennsylvania rise up against the first excise taxes, who's the one who leads the charge to crush the farmers' revolt? Even George Washington doesn't have the stomach to do it, but Alexander Hamilton does. He calls Native American savages that have to be eliminated for our economy to grow. That's why I say that the founding fathers had no love for us. This is why Donald Trump talked about making America great again. He made a historical pitch in 2016. It may have been a coded pitch. Some people argue, to me, it was just kind of a wide, you know, in your face kind of pitch. If you read what John Adams said about the Mexican War of Independence, what Thomas Jefferson said about the Haitian Revolution, it's almost exactly the same kind of thing Trump says today. Here's another example. I was asked, by the way, I shouldn't tell you where Matt and I had coffee earlier today. It was in a chain cafe. I'm very embarrassed about that. but then someone told me that Pete started here, so it's okay. You know, sorry about that. I'm sorry. But a couple folks came up to me and they said, you know, you're a historian. Tell us what time period, this time period most, that, that Tell us, you know, what this time period now looks like to you, and what other time period in American history is most like this time period, right? I think it's kind of a trick question. But I said, you know, to me, and talking to Matt about this, it is very much like 1930 again. The world is in a global crisis. Certain people are coming to power, not just in the United States, but throughout the entire world. The term strongmen, authoritarian, masculine, hyper-masculine characters, it's not a mistake. It's connected to a global crisis in capitalism. When Herbert Hoover was elected to president, and by the way, when I ask my I'll ask my students a question, well, who was the president that presided over the initial part of the Great Depression? You know, 9 times out of 10, they say J. Edgar Hoover. I find that to be very interesting. Now, Hoover was very powerful, right? But what I tell them is I say, I want us to think about the Great Depression and how Herbert Hoover, believe it or not, up to that point is probably the smartest man who's ever president of the United States. He was brilliant, right? Brilliant engineer, brilliant planner. He had one of the smartest cabinets that's ever been assembled in Washington, D.C. But when the Great Depression broke out and it was clear that it wasn't just a one-time, one-off thing, that it was a national and it was an international crisis, who did Hoover's cabinet blame for the onset of the Great Depression? Who were the first people to be blamed? Mexicans, poor people. The United States government seized and went into communities and terrorized and kidnapped, abducted and deported over 1 million Mexican Americans and sent them to Mexico. Some of them had never stepped foot inside Mexico. Matt's family, my family, were impacted by this. But this is something, talking to Matt beforehand, we didn't talk about growing up. It was my great, you know, grandparents' generation. It was considered to be a shameful thing to be terrorized like that. And no one ever told me this growing up. I had to ask questions. And so to me, my students have to deal with the fact that they may have federal agents in their backyards right now spying on them, abducting their parents. In Florida, parents who lack state-issued IDs cannot even step foot in their children's schools. So how can they be part of the education? Education is supposed to be the ticket out, right? And so that's why I think those two time periods on the negative side resonate, but also on the other, on the more positive side, these incipient movements, you know, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers movement. Right now, we're looking at the Supreme Court, but I can tell you, whatever decision the Supreme Court makes, immigrant rights activists and labor activists are not going to quit. They're going to keep struggling. They're going to keep fighting. There's a reason this nation didn't go fascist in the 1930s. I mean, as bad as it was, right, as bad as Jim Crow was and lynching, there's a reason it didn't get worse. The reason is that people organized together. We had members of my family involved in the Little Steel Strike in 1937. This is a sacred moment if you're a labor union or labor activist member. When they organized the Little Steel Strike in Chicago, and Inland Steel and some of the other smaller steel corporations, the Chicago police came out and shot and murdered 10 workers. And the headlines read, the Chicago police were interviewed about this, "Oh, we only killed Mexicans and Bolsheviks, and that was supposed to make it okay." But you know what? Those workers didn't stop organizing, and they unionized all those plants. And we just have to be as persistent as our ancestors in struggle.
All right. Let's give a hand to Paul Ortiz.
Thank you.
Intense. And so is this next question. Why should a person of color fight for a country that won't fight for them?
I'll answer the question by posing that question as if I was still in the military. You know, in the military, we fight for each other. We fight for our comrades. We fight for the people that are in the trenches next to us. And I think in this case, we're fighting for our neighbors. We're fighting for the people who have been deeply oppressed. We're fighting for the 12 million undocumented people who answered the call of American business when it needed help. And now it's turned. And now we've turned our backs on those workers. You know, we're fighting for each other. We're not fighting for an abstract idea. You know, James Baldwin said it best. I love my country, and therefore I criticize my country. And the criticisms are going to be tough. They're going to be hard-hitting. But I'm making the criticisms. And it wasn't that he was saying that he loved the U.S. as an abstract idea. He loved the people around him. I want to share a story from El Sereno, if my brother Matt Cedillo will allow me for a minute to share the story. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the El Sereno neighborhood in East Los Angeles. It's one of America's iconic Chicano neighborhoods. And a number of years ago, actually in 2014, one of my former PhD students, Jonathan Gomez, who's now an assistant professor of Chicano studies at San Jose State University, one of the great universities in this country. Jonathan and I got a call from a couple teachers from Garfield High School in Los Angeles. Garfield is one of our iconic, you know, Chicano majority, people of color majority high schools, right? They even have made movies about this high school. That's how iconic it is. What was that? Stand and Deliver, yeah, and there's been others as well. We got a call from a couple teachers at Garfield, and they were telling us, you know, our